appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hearing. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Ari Deneal Johnson wishes to be sworn into the court.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas McGarry. I'm a partner at Hinshaw & Culbertson. I'm pleased this morning to make a motion for admission of Mr. Ari Johnson to the bar of this court. Assuming the motion is granted, Mr. Johnson would participate in arguing the case of United States versus Smith, which is docketed for 9:30. And this is a criminal justice appeal act case. My firm and my partner, Josh Vincent, has undertaken 6 of those cases and has assigned responsibilities to Mr. Johnson for this case. He would be here this morning because he has supervisory authority over these cases, and he is arguing an appeal in the appellate court of Illinois, so hopefully he'll be able to come over here, but I'll be sitting with Mr. Johnson this morning, and again, assuming that the motion is granted, he'll be up here arguing his first appeal.
Where is he licensed to practice?
Mr. Johnson is licensed in Illinois, has been associated with my firm for 2 years, but he was licensed in 2002, a May 2002 graduate, Northern Illinois Law School. And when he graduated, he had several honors. One of those was actually a champion of the moot court team and was noted for writing one of the best briefs. He won an award for the best brief in a regional competition in moot court.
All right, Mr. Johnson. We're happy to have you join the bar. Please walk over and take the oath.
Thank you very much.
All right, we will proceed with the United States versus Jakubowski.
May it please the court. We're urging the court to reverse Mr. Jakubowski's conviction based on the Second Amendment. When the Second Amendment was adopted, it was intended to prevent the federal government from disarming the populace. There's a prefatory clause about the militia, but the core operative part of the amendment deals with the right of the people to keep and bear arms. With respect to the prefatory clause, it deals with the militia. But the militia, at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, consisted of the entire polity, which at that time was the entire male, able-bodied male population. So the purpose, and in fact, the United States Supreme Court in Miller recognized that. You look at, for example, the Federalist 46, which is quoted in the Emerson case, Madison recognizes that. So when you talk about a militia, you're talking about the whole population. And where we disagree with the Seventh Circuit precedent is Gillespie, in cases like that, seemed to focus on what would have been the select militia, which is the current equivalent of the National Guard. The Second Amendment deals with the conception of the militia back in 1791, which was the entire populace, not the small group of people who regularly met and engaged in training and so on. The purpose of the Bill of Rights was to gain acceptance for the Constitution. The Articles of Confederation and their government was too weak, but there was a genuine fear among the anti-federalists that a government under the Constitution would be too strong. And the Second Amendment was one of the vehicles by which acceptance of the Constitution was obtained. And the way the Second Amendment was perceived as working then was that if the federal government became too strong, became too oppressive, an armed populace would rise up and oppose it. The populace, in order to rise up, had to already be armed, and in fact, it largely was armed. So the armed populace comes before the militia. This is not a matter of arming a small group of people like our current National Guard. This is preventing the federal government from disarming the populace so the populace can resist the federal government if it becomes too oppressive. This was the fundamental purpose of the Second Amendment. And it was accepted as such at the time. I quote from
the federal government has no role constitutionally in regulation of firearms, period.
Not with respect to firearms appropriate for militia service, such as handguns and rifles, yes. It may have a role with respect to, you know, Abrams tanks or something, you know, artillery pieces or Derringers, which seem to have some special status back then. But the core weapons of firearms and rifles, the answer to that is yes. The federal government is precluded by the Second Amendment from having any role in that. That's our position, and we believe that that's the correct position.
Isn't this an issue, really, that if you're correct that the Supreme Court's going to have to address? And
I think the Supreme
Court... Our court, guided by Supreme Court, existing Supreme Court precedent, would have to reject your argument.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think this is certainly something that's going to end up in the Supreme Court before too much longer. But I think if Emerson has whatever one thinks of the Emerson's conclusion, it has an excellent historical analysis, which I think shows that the Supreme Court precedent on this is very unclear, and it does not give this court a clear roadmap as to what it should do. Miller is not an unequivocal statement about what the Second Amendment means. So,
well, it's not an unequivocal statement that the government has no role in regulating felons in possession of.
I agree. I think what I think is that basically an open ball game is what my submission would be, and it would. I mean, certainly the Fifth Circuit is being adventuresome in this area, there's a tremendous amount of scholarship saying, wait a minute, we've got to go back to basic principles, and I think it's. I mean, I would suggest that we have such an open field here, it would not be inappropriate for this court to.
Well, you said we'd be this circuit is being adventuresome, we'd be adventuresome plus, wouldn't we?
Well, I mean, the Fifth Circuit is taking a position that's supported by people that support firearms ownership. Most of the opposition comes from people who think that all governments should be able to regulate firearms. My position, I would submit, is actually right down the middle and is much more consistent with the historical record. So I don't think it's as adventuresome as the extreme positions. I think it's a centrist position. And I think it's consistent not only with Second Amendment jurisprudence, but also with the Supreme Court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence, which talks about this kind of law enforcement being in the province of state and local government. So I think it dovetails the Second Amendment and the Commerce Clause very nicely.
So if you're right, then the states have the sole responsibility for legislating in this area, and if a state passed legislation prohibiting possession of firearms, you could not raise the Second Amendment argument.
Yes, Judge.
Against that.
And I would submit that was the situation in 1791. There was extensive state regulation of firearms. There was no federal regulation of firearms. Federal regulation is a recent phenomenon. And what I'm suggesting is what was in place in 1791 is what should be in place today. And so what I was going to move into was this convergence of the Commerce Clause. I'm not asking the court to rule on a Commerce Clause basis. I'm asking the court to rule on a Second Amendment basis, but clearly the Commerce Clause jurisprudence informs the Second Amendment jurisprudence, and Morrison and Lopez talk about spheres of responsibility, and Morrison talks about the suppression of violent crime being undeniably left reposed in the states. And as I said, back in 1791, there was a fair amount of firearms regulation on the part of the states, including felons. And certainly this case illustrates that the states are ready, willing, and able to enforce firearms laws, because the state of Illinois did with respect to Mr. Jacobowski, with respect to the very guns that are at issue in this case. And so the public interest in having firearms either enforced or not enforced, according to what the people of a particular state think, the state and local governments are fully capable of effectuating that that policy and that need. So I would submit that this is an area that is under active litigation throughout the country, that the position that I have posited is most consistent with the law and of both the Second Amendment and the Commerce Clause, and I would ask this court to reverse and vacate Mr. Jacobowski's conviction. Thank you.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Charles X, and I represent the government in this matter. The Supreme Court case law, as well as the case law of the circuit, is unequivocal in upholding the exceptions to the Second Amendment, which allow the federal government to regulate the possession and use of firearms. This court in Gillespie versus Indianapolis spoke specifically to this issue. The same type of statute, 922G, different provision, sub 9 instead of sub 1, but the rationale is exactly the same. The court held that that particular status, and in that case, a individual who was convicted of a domestic violent offense could not be in the possession of a firearm, and into that federal regulation was permissible. There is nothing to distinguish this case, and in fact, the Supreme Court precedent that my opponent has cited, both United States versus Lewis and U.S. versus Miller, are unequivocal in holding that there are exceptions to the Second Amendment. I don't think there's any controversy. I don't wish to belabor what the precedent is, and I would agree that it would be up to the Supreme Court to change the law as it exists. Counsel seems to have withdrawn his argument as far as the Commerce Clause as being an independent basis. I know in his brief he argued that it is not a valid exercise of the Commerce Clause authority. Again, this this court has already spoken many, many, many times that 922G is in fact a valid exercise of the Commerce Clause authority. And as far as his arguments that the that there should be some reservation to the states as the exclusive regulator or of firearms, I just think there's absolutely no no precedent or authority for that proposition. I would submit that all the cases that we have cited in our brief show that there is a valid exercise of Commerce Clause authority, and when there's a valid exercise of Commerce Clause authority, then there can be no state infringement of rights. That's, I think, a very basic proposition. And unless there are any further questions, the government would respectfully request this court affirm the conviction and sentence of John Jacobowski in all respects.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have anything else to add?
Your Honor, I have nothing to add to my brief.
Fine. We will take the case under advisement and proceed.